Welcome to the playoffs edition of The Dirty Inning, your favorite Phillies podcast about the dumbest, worst, or most forgettable innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. I am Justin Clue, writer with Baseball Prospectus and Fangraphs, and with me is Dr. Trevor Strunk as we begin our journey.
Hello.
I forgot. I should have given you the space there, and I just kept talking.
Yeah, well, that's all right. It's fine.
I'm going to get in there, Justin. Don't you worry.
I'll just bust right in. It makes it easier for you, I think.
I understand. Well, this is an NLCS-themed episode. We're going back to one of the Phillies' many, many playoff appearances to talk about one of their, you know, many losses in the playoffs. So that's going to be a fun little adventure for us. I mean, Trev, the playoffs, baseball's playoffs are happening right now. The NLCS happening right under our fingers as we speak. And I got to tell you, it's pretty thrilling to watch the Washington Nationals go up 6-0 on the St. Louis Cardinals, frankly. This is an ideal situation.
You're really, really selling this.
It's an ideal situation to see them go up 3-0, you know, pretty much probably guarantee a sweep as they're playing at least one more and, you know, two if they need to, games in Washington. So, yeah, this series seems like it's really going somewhere. It'll be remembered as one of the greats, another classic clash between the Redbirds of St. Louis and those Nationals of Washington.
I could see just because it's the the Cardinals, I could see them somehow pulling something out of their hats where they win the series somehow. But I mean, that's just mostly paranoia. I think the Nationals probably have this in the bank.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, but if you've been watching this series at all, Cardinals devil magic is over. A couple years ago, we watched the even year Giants lose to the Cubs on their way.
I remember that.
Yeah, heck shattering. Historical, not just for baseball, but just, you know, culture in general in this country. The Cubs on their way to finally reversing that curse and making that history, just plowed right through an even year Giants team, which was just
thought that could happen.
That was a heroic thing that happened, frankly. You know, like the Cubs wound up milkshake ducking themselves. Obviously, everybody does. And I honestly I'm seeing the pattern emerge again. Like this Nationals team, it's a pretty likable team, especially when compared, except for the uniforms they're wearing, but especially when you compare them to the Cardinals team, which is most famous in these playoffs for being like, Ronald Acuna sucks, and we throw inside on Ronald Acuna, and he just needs to man up and stop with those antics out there, enjoying himself, throwing his bat around, running around the bases like some kind of, I don't like it. Like, that's the hallmark of an antagonist in the playoffs. Nobody wants to see. The Cardinals are old. Like, Cardinals devil magic is old itself. Like, that's not even fun and funny anymore. It was great to see them decimate the Braves in the last game of that NLDS.
Yeah, no, that was great. That was what we were all rooting for. I kind of feel bad because, like, I feel like I kind of got on board with them briefly because they were playing the Braves. And now I'm just like, yeah, sorry, that's over now.
This has been a lot of lessons in, okay, how do you objectively watch a baseball game when you definitely hate both teams? But this is such a common scenario. I'm just like, how many teams do I really hate? And it just comes down to like the last team the Phillies played where you waded at all into the commentary of their fans or something. Or like see an outside fan's opinion on one of the players you've been watching all year. Even if you have no feelings about them whatsoever, you're just like, hey, shut the fuck up. What the hell? Shut up. Cesar Hernandez.
That's where I'm at with the Nationals, where like I think they're actually super likable and I like the team. But then I remember that the fans are like, haha, we got rid of that loser Bryce and now we're in the playoffs. Like,
it's tough to stomach that. And they have a player.
Know how baseball works.
And they have a young player who is so good and between pitches stares down the pitcher while punching himself in the dick. I don't know how else to explain what coolness in baseball is beyond that image. And their fans have made me not want them to win. They're going to, but they've made me not want them to.
My former Good Fight contributor and my friend Lee Goldsmith texted me and said, every time I look at Juan Soto in the batter's box, I feel like he's flirting with me.
No,
it's true. It really feels very sexual the whole time.
Mm-hmm. It's becoming deeply erotic, and you can tell the Cardinals don't like it.
But they kind of do.
Well, they're clearly off their game. So
yeah, you know. No, he's really he's throwing them.
Mm-hmm. But my point is that the vibes coming off this Nationals team, even before tonight, even before they were up 6-0, knocking in at this point 24 of their 36 runs in this series with two outs. Even before that, they are out devil magicking the Cardinals, and I think they're destined this season to be one of these Cubs teams that, like, they're going to win their first. The AL's got a couple of teams that are just playing a different sport than the NL this year, so that it remains to be seen. But let's just say they go all the way to the World Series, and in a hypothetical situation, they win it. It's the same kind of narrative track that it's like it would be the first World Series in their franchise history. Talk to their fans, and they'll act like they're a long-suffering fan group. I completely resent that and think it's utter dog shit, but yeah. Whatever. They've been a team for, like, less than 15 years. But regardless, they've been just long suffering, quote unquote, fan base. And it's just kind of like time for the Nationals to win, because they've had a lot of good teams. And the Cubs had a lot of good teams that didn't win the World Series. So it's just kind of like the Nationals' time, I think, to do it and to go to bypass one of the old narratives, one of the dustier ones from a couple of years ago. Yeah, like I said, Cardinals devil magic just isn't new anymore. It's worn off. It's not going to do the trick. Cardinals can't just skate by hoping that the other players are going to, like, be chasing a line drive and run into a bird or something. Like, it's not going to happen.
I think you're being unfair, because isn't it super charming to imagine those upstart Yankees winning?
I mean, the AL is, I mean, this is why this postseason is just, if you're looking at the uniforms, just an utter nightmare. But that's what I mean. Like, I would have been rooting for the Astros a couple years ago, but there's just so much to remember about every one of these teams. Every one of these teams in the playoffs, you're like, oh, yeah, it's a reason, the legitimate reason to, like, despise this team.
Last year, I rooted for the Astros kind of because I wanted them to win their first World Series. Like, I would have been fine with the Dodgers winning too, because that's, I don't know, they haven't won one in a while, and I know some Dodgers fans, but I was like, you know what, it'd be cool if the Astros won their first World Series ever. Why not?
That was not the World Series last year, just so you know.
The World Series last year was the Red Sox and the Dodgers. Who did the Astros play against? Why am I not remembering this?
They did play against the Dodgers. That was it. Okay, it was in 2017.
Sorry.
Trevor has a very long white beard. He goes to sleep for really long periods of time.
My name's Rip Van Strunk. I agree. I think it's like, it's, I wanted the Astros to win their first World Series, and then I just, now I could never see them win one again and be fine. So, Nationals, I guess, and then there are more teams in the league that I just don't care about. And then when we get the full set, baseball ends.
That's what it is, though. It's like, oh, Nationals, okay, they're winning their first one. They do this once, and it's beautiful. It's, oh, what a moment. They try to do it again, devil magic. That's when that comes in, and suddenly you're hated. Right. Look at the Cubs. I hate the Cubs. I forget why. Probably Joe Maddon. You know, like, but a couple years ago,
but he's
I been
gone.
Like,
do you still hate them?
I mean, I kind of don't remember them. They made themselves so forgettable this year that I'm like, man, they were not even really annoying, because the Phillies handled the Cubs quite easily. One of the few teams they were able to beat this year. So, you know, it's the nature of fandom. And speaking of fandom. In 1976 Philadelphia, Triv, fandom was, look, we've seen a couple of Phillies playoff teams over the years, and you haven't always felt great about the Phillies' chances going into the playoffs, but you've always been, don't let me speak for you, but you've always been, you know, at least a little excited. Teams going into the playoffs.
For sure.
Like, hey, it's the postseason and the Phillies are in it.
October. We love October.
They got swept out of the NLDS in 2007 by the Rockies. That didn't feel great. 2009 World Series, had a bad feeling going into that. Had a bad feeling going into that. And it's just, you find yourself up against that wall, and your hopeful optimism kind of more quickly than I think usual will wither away into really just like backed into a corner ferocity or misery. And in 1976, boy, I wish I could have lived in this Philadelphia, because I have never seen a city that didn't just not believe in their team that was in the playoffs. They actively hated, and in some cases were rooting against their own players.
Incredible.
And mostly in the media, mostly on the part of the writers covering this team. It was excellent. It was peak. That, like, we talk about writers from bygone eras and how they kind of...
Oh, the 70s are a bygone era. Absolutely.
they consider it part of their job to like antagonize the team, which is like, okay, I'm sure that, yeah, it, that's a way to go about it. Yeah. They just, you know, they, and this was weapons grade that. And well,
Justin, if we're going back to 1976, stop in the old time machine. You hop in the time machine with me. Watch your head. Here it comes. You know,
press the button and okay.
Oh, what a night. Do, 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 do. Just step out the back, Jack. Make a new play and say.
Wow. Why do we always step out right next to where someone's playing music on a jukebox?
It's very strange. It's really weird. And they're all top 100 songs from that year. It's like usually a jukebox plays a lot of different things. But
this is so relevant.
Yeah. Tell me something. No, that's not from that year. It's jukebox broke. Now it's the news radio. And turns out, Justin, there's a lot of things happening in 1976. Do you want to talk about it?
Absolutely not. I was going to say, let's lend an ear and see what gives in the city of Philly.
In January, crime author Agatha Christie has died.
Good.
Very sad. Oh, not a fan?
Under mysterious circumstances, I assume.
She was killed, and several detectives tried to solve the mystery. They were unable to, and it remains unsolved, unfortunately. The Northern Ireland Constitutional Convention was formally dissolved in Northern Ireland, which means that London ruled Northern Ireland. And in 1976, that didn't lead to any problems later on.
Yeah. I mean, it was either that or the Phillies that people were talking about in Philadelphia. So I get why you brought that up.
That would lead to the troubles and many of the deaths of both Irish people and British people in bombings and tortures. Let's see here. In March, the Toronto Blue Jays were created.
Hey!
How about that? That's... You never hear baseball news in this thing. It's this dumb news channel never has baseball. Let's see what else. The great bookie robbery happened in Melbourne when bandits stole Australian dollars, $1.4 million Australian dollars in bookmaker settlements from Queen Street, Melbourne.
You said that like it was going to be something everyone would recognize.
And you did, right?
And let me tell you something. Mission accomplished.
Karen Ann Quinlan was taken off of her ventilator. The Supreme Court said you could mercy kill someone if they didn't have brain function. That was new.
Nice.
The Teton Dam collapsed in southeast Idaho. There was also a plane crash in Malaysia. And that wacky comedy you love, Star Wars, began filming in Tunisia, which I actually did not know it filmed in Tunisia.
Agatha Christie's last project.
Yes. Unfortunately, she wrote it, but never saw it released.
Yeah. And I actually did know they filmed the Tatooine scenes in Tunisia. I don't know why I knew that. Yeah. So
good for you. I'm impressed. Yeah,
really good for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's true.
Yeah. It's going really well for me. Thanks.
You're really just like, you're thriving is what you're telling me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. All right. Cool. And let's see if we can do one more. Oh, here's kind of a seedy one. A gunman murders Andrea Wilborn and Stan Farr and injures two others at a mansion in Fort Worth. T. Cullen Davis, Priscilla's husband, one of the richest men in Texas, is tried and found innocent for the murder and an involvement to kill several people and a wrongful death lawsuit, but then goes broke afterwards.
All lived happily ever after.
Sorted. Wow. Oh, and the Seattle Seahawks played their first football game. So you can decide which is the worst tragedy.
People died. Yeah, real people.
Come on.
Well, in 1976, the Phillies were on their way to still not winning a World Series title. And Philadelphia knew it. And many, many, many times, the Phillies' hometown paper indicated that they knew one undeniable fact about this series with the Cincinnati Reds, that at the end of October 12th, 1976, it would be over, because the Phillies, according to reports, and I can't stress this enough, sucked, and nobody believed in them. And let me tell you something, Trev. A team is never more dangerous than when they're cornered, when their backs are against the wall, and when nobody believes they can do it. And you know what? These 1976 Phillies grabbed themselves by the stirrups You know, they brought themselves up that morning. They got to the field and they lost this game very, very stupidly and did not play in the rest of the playoffs because they were eliminated. So
cool.
At this point in the series, the Phillies were down 2-0. Absolutely no one was feeling it. Dick Allen's tumultuous time in Philadelphia was in its prime. As one writer blamed
lefty.
this is phenomenal. Dick Allen's little thread here.
One
writer blamed Allen for 6 of the 12 runs the Reds had scored on the Phillies in the series' first two games due to a pair of misplays at first base. This is from a Bruce Keiden column that ran on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer on
the immortal Bruce Keiden
on the day of this game. They talk of coming back from the brink of the chasm into which they are sliding, but it is barracks bravado. They make little jokes about their situation, but it is death row humor. They are the Phillies. They are the hollow men of the baseball postseason.
Oh my God.
And today may see the last remnant of their dream of a World Series disappear. Let me just say here, Jesus Christ!
Wow.
I've spent most of my life not believing in the Phillies, and even I'm like, fucking let up, man. Like, they've still got a game to play.
I really like that he basically set it up as if it was like All Quiet on the Western Front, but about the Phillies. Like it's like, like he's just some guy who has his legs blown off in a bunker, and he's like, I just got to write one last poem to express the horrors of rooting for the Phillies before I die.
I just want someone to find this and give it to my parents when I'm killed by this tragedy, when I don't live through to see the mourning. I want this to be the last thing I'm known for.
I need them to know that I never believed in the Phillies.
Like, sure, people know this team fucking sucks. not the Phillies year, not 1976, and definitely not going against the Big Red Machine, who were a terrifying baseball team. That they were in every way better than the Phillies. And they knew that as much as the local writers knew the Phillies were not good. At least Joe Morgan did. And while he did, a Philadelphia Inquirer reporters presumably nodded in agreement with him. This is also from the Inquirer. This is Joe Morgan. Imagine a player today giving like real, this is the other thing, real ass answers to questions reporters were asking at this time. You're obviously going to get a lot of like diplomatic or nothing answers. If you're talking to Zach Greinke, that's probably the closest thing to an honest answer you get, which is him just being like, I don't want to be here.
I don't want to talk to you. Like, please don't make me do this.
Exactly. But this was Joe Morgan talking about the Phillies. They couldn't beat us 1 out of 2 in their own park, said Reds outstanding second baseman Joe Morgan. How can they think they'd beat us 3 straight in ours? The answer is the Phillies don't think so. Not really. Oh, they still make the appropriate noises in answer to questions from reporters.
oh, no.
Even the Phillies can't be thinking that they're actually going to win this game. All this from the Inquirer, while simultaneously it one column over, they were trying to hawk this Phillies medallion in exchange for you subscribing to the newspaper.
Why would you ever want it?
Why would you want that? Here's one column where they're like, this piece of shit team thinks it's gonna like win 1 game out of 3. Where they're kidding themselves. These men are delusional. Now, subscribe to our newspaper for more coverage like this, and we will give you a necklace with that team we were just talking about's logo on it. And not only that, but the autographs of everyone on this terrible team that's not gonna make it to the World Series.
Garbage team you hate. You're just furious at this team. You're just like, you cannot get over how bad it is. And we're here to sell you some more cards about this, some more newspapers on that.
Yep. Page one is this column explaining that this team blew its chance at winning the NLCS by losing both of the games that started in Philly, that there was no hope, that the players were expressing hope, that the players that were expressing hope were lying, that Joe Morgan was right. But hey, how about this medallion inscribed with all of their autographs? Quite the gift, right?
Definitely buy it for your loved ones.
A subscription to this newspaper they were offering that the day the Hometown Nine was playing in an elimination game, they ran a short article by Frank Dolson about how much better a person Pete Rose was than Dick Allen.
What?
Let's just sit here in 2019 and reflect on those ethical instincts.
Can you
shown
tell me
by
anything
the...
about this column?
I absolutely can and will. I might just read you the whole thing.
I would love to hear it. I can't imagine what the... Oh my God.
So listen to this. Dolson points out that the Reds starters were all out during Cincinnati's infield practice. But the Phillies version of infield practice was mostly backups while the starters were in the clubhouse playing cards. He rabidly lauds Pete Rose spending an extra 10 minutes at writing the word extra in all caps. And then followed Allen with his eyes throughout the Phillies first baseman's warmups. He talked about how he came out onto the field 15 minutes after the warm-up had started. How Allen had gone over to shortstop and, quote, goofed around, according to Dolson. Then he went to second base and, quote, goofed around and didn't really exert himself in a real way. He didn't use the word lazy, but it was everywhere in this piece. And he even let Rose, he talked to Rose for this story. Like, granted, I'm not sure Dick Allen was talking to the press at this point, so maybe he couldn't get an interview with him anyway, but like, he talks to Rose for this quote unquote story and gets some quotes from him that are basically just like, yep, I'm a good little baseball boy. I do the best job. The headline of this article was Rose could teach Allen sweaty smell of success.
Ew.
What the hell is that?
Why do people think this? I mean, obvious. Okay, so like, just to be clear, this is just racism. And just so if anyone is wondering, if we know that, of course it's racism. What in the world, though? Like, why? I mean, I guess Pete Rose is like an incredible baseball player at this point. The only reason he's not in the Hall of Fame is because of all of his bad deeds. I just don't understand why you would write this column. I don't understand any part of it. Like, is the hope that Dick Allen reads it and gets better? Is the hope that the Phillies trade for Pete Rose? Like, what's the...
I think both of those things are true. Yeah. But also because of, like, you know, racism that was prominent in the area.
Sure.
And trying to provoke a reaction. I mean, how else do you write something like this in a place where you know everybody's going to see it? Again, at this point, Dick Allen might have just been ignoring media, which he should have. That's what I would have done.
I mean, yeah,
in his shoes. So this is I'll read a little bit of this column.
Please, I want to hear more.
Dolson says, before the first game of the National League playoffs, Pete Rose spent 10 minutes fielding ground balls at third base. 10 extra minutes. 10 minutes that he didn't have to spend.
Wow.
I'm going to do my best Pete Rose impression. I always take extra ground balls on the first day of a series, Rose said.
I get him.
That's him saying that, yeah, any series, not just the playoffs. He comes out and he takes some extra ground balls because he's just a special, special guy. As Frank Dolson writes, that's the Pete Rose way. Also the Cincinnati Reds way. It is no accident that they have destroyed the Phillies in the first two games of what was supposed to be a super series. They came ready to play. Their opponents didn't.
I walked out the other day at Veterans Stadium, Rose said yesterday. There were 60,000 people there, and the Phillies were taking infield practice. John Vukovich was at third, Jim Catt was at short, Tommy Hutton and Bobby Tolan were at first. We take infield practice, Tony Perez is at first, Joe Morgan is at second, Dave Concepcion is at short, I'm at third.
So that was basically him calling out the Phillies for, like, not doing warm-ups right. He threw in at the end, because it was mentioned, oh, the Phillies were in their clubhouse playing cards.
Once the bus arrives at the ballpark, we aren't allowed to play cards. Oh,
so, you know, throwing some more shade.
Yeah,
so,
bet on the team.
Look, granted, should the Phillies in an elimination game been, like, you know, fucking around in the clubhouse playing cards?
Who cares?
Probably not, but, like, that's
probably not.
Like, they probably shouldn't have been doing that, but you're not going to tell me that 10 minutes of extra ground ball work is going to make the difference in this series. And, like, I get what he's saying. Pete Rose is a hard worker. Dick Allen is not. And, you know, that makes the Reds the better team. Obviously, Dick Allen was a tremendous baseball player whose potential was absolutely squashed, partially because of an environment like this. But it was... giving Pete Rose a little stool to pat himself on the back and talking shit about Dick Allen in an era where Dick Allen received no coverage unless it was talking shit about him. I mean, just getting a little sample of this. He says 10 extra minutes again and throws extra in all capital letters. It's not the best article I've ever read.
Oh, really?
He's the one who says the two bad plays contributed to the six of the 12 runs the Reds had scored. And he closes up the article by saying, after watching him play the last couple of days, you couldn't help but think how helpful it would be if somebody on this club, the manager, the owner, somebody, had the authority to tell the first baseman to work out at first base, or if the first baseman had the sense to do it on his own. But he doesn't, and perhaps that best explains why the Reds are playing so well in this series and the Phillies are playing so badly. That little conclusion of, well, Dick Allen doesn't warm up right, so that's why the Phillies suck, makes no sense. The champions, as usual, are doing it Pete Rose's way. The challengers, sadly, seem to be doing it Dick Allen's. Lot to read into there. Woof.
Man. What's so weird to me about all this is that, like, it assumes that, and I mean, this isn't new news. This is what always happens. But I love that the assumption that, like, oh yeah, like, you know, anyone who plays baseball doesn't know enough to be able to, like, BS their way through warmups. Like, if you're playing baseball professionally for a living, you need those warmups, or else you will forget how to field ground balls.
Your body stops working.
Yeah, they're not for getting loose and, like, getting ready to play. They're for remembering how to play baseball.
Exactly. A baseball player goes to sleep at night. They go into these little pods where their natural bodies kind of crumble and rot, and
then
they turn to dust. A clubhouse staffer comes by with a little dirt devil and just vacuums up the corpse dust. And overnight, a new first baseman is grown inside that pod. And if he doesn't come out and warm up before the game, he has absolutely no idea what is going on. So that makes a little sense in that regard.
You know, I forgot about the pods. I'm sorry.
Right. That was a big part of baseball in the 70s.
Yeah, right. I'm glad they stopped doing that. I'm glad they just make them slaves now.
Yeah, it was upsetting. It was really an unsettling version of the game that I hope is really behind us.
I like how at the end of the games and those, if you watch the old broadcasts, the players all scream in unison and melt away.
I remember that part of the yearbook. Yeah, that was. Why did they include that?
Oh wow, this should be a secret.
Telling Phillies, but yo, this really should have been a secret. you guys keep so much other stuff under wraps, but this got out.
This is horrible. Why would you tell me about this?
I will never forget that I saw this. Well, speaking of unforgettable, no, not really, but. That's the transition I've decided to go with. We're going to take our first break here and get back to the rest of this 1976 NLCS disaster right after this. Well, Dick Allen or not, the Phillies were playing in the 1976 NLCS, Trev, and they were playing in Game 3 on October 12th, 1976 against a Cincinnati Reds team that was probably going to win coming into the series, was now definitely going to win now that they were up 2-0 and only had to win one more game to win it. And they had the full support of the entire city of Cincinnati and sounds like the entire press of Philadelphia.
Great.
But not only the press, Trev. A Phillies player, Jay Johnstone's wife, was documented not believing in her husband's team as well.
Oh, God. What is with this? I mean, like, I get... Like, so I get making fun of the teams you cover. I totally do. And, like, you see it in the press today. You see it in people saying, like, you know, like, it may as well just, like, you know, at the end of the year, they're basically saying, like, can we please just sim the rest of the season? But, man, the spouses of any of these players are supposed to be the ones that are like, hey, anything can happen. It's baseball.
Hey, you know what? In Mary Jane's defense, it's not like they stuck a mic in her face and she was like, this team sucks, they're going to blow it. Pretty much exactly what you just described is what happened. I'll read this. I think this is from the Daily News. It says, a local television reporter greeted Jay Johnstone's wife, Mary Jane, as she entered the airport here. Why are the Phillies going to win 3 straight? The reporter demanded, thrusting a microphone into Mrs. Johnston's face. Because the Reds are a machine, but the Phillies have heart, Mrs. Johnston answered.
Oh, no.
The TV reporter turned away, and Mrs. Johnston nudged a friend. How could I say a thing like that? She wondered. She said, because it is expected, because it is considered bad form to admit that your team is outgunned and without hope. This is all in the paper. So, like, what? She gave the interview question, and then they heard her mutter something to her friend, and then I guess stuck the mic back in her face. They
were like, care to answer that thing you just muttered to your friend? Well, of course, hey, I would.
You just said that directly into the microphone. I don't know if you realize this, but, yeah, this is all on the record. So, yeah, so she had to answer that. I mean, don't you imagine, like, if that's something like that happens today... Well, A, I could see something like that being like the top item on the the news Twitter news feed. But like, you know, local athlete's wife doesn't believe in team, like, that's easily. But also, I feel like a professional courtesy where that doesn't get out at all probably is more likely, where it's like, oh, I overheard you say something that would be really embarrassing for you. And this is just a sporting event, not like actual important news. So
what I like about it is that, like, nowadays it's sort of the nowadays reporting basically is, you know, get the news, because if you don't, someone else will get the news and you'll be fired. Whereas it's basically just like the Daily Planet all the time. whereas in the past, it's like, you know, okay, yes, obviously it's a very competitive industry, but, like, you know, the editor of the Inquirer is not going to fire you if, you don't get this person's wife's, thoughts down in the paper. And furthermore, you could assume, maybe you would hope that, like, the people from the Daily News and the people from the other newspapers are, like, also okay with not humiliating a woman. But it's actually the opposite. Like, now we'd be like, oh, I don't want to humiliate this woman, even if it would help my job. And then they were like, sorry, lady, news is news.
Deadline's in 5 minutes. I got to get to a phone.
It's really, yeah, it's just, what a horrible place to live.
Well, Jay Johnston's, he was a noted goofball of sorts.
Yeah, we've talked about him in the show.
Yeah, so I'm sure if his wife was like, I made a joke, he would have been like, I get it. He wouldn't have been like, what, you said what? Throw a chair at a mirror, you know, that kind of stuff.
I really hope he didn't do that.
I mean, I feel like I'm sure he didn't.
Turn into a Lifetime original movie kind of moment.
Another thing that seems like it probably wouldn't have been something that got out was that Tug McGraw was hanging out on the field before the game when he spotted Johnny Bench and called to him saying, if we can't win this thing, I hope you guys do. And a reporter nearby whispered, don't worry, they will.
That rocks. That's so good.
Oh my god! Like, this is just active taunting. This isn't even like antagonistic reporting. This is just in the Phillies' face taunting.
Can you imagine? And I know this isn't like, maybe it's hacky of me to keep saying, can you imagine? Can you imagine? But like, can you imagine being like, you okay? Like, try to win, I guess. It's not gonna work.
Yeah, like, what are you guys even, what is this even for? Who is this for?
Yeah.
Who do you think's watching at this point?
Oh, so Bryce is in right field tonight? Oh, wow. Sure, that's going to make a difference. Something wrong, man? Or are you just like, yeah, whatever, it's fine.
How many people do you think are coming tonight? Yeah. Yeah, nobody. Yeah. That's who wants to watch this team.
Lowball it. Lowball it some more.
Yeah, so.
So great.
Yeah, a little interesting. It's a different time, I suppose. So with the local media staunchly against them, like pretty much rooting against them, the Phillies took the field on October 12th, 1976, apparently fully prepared to be on their way home by the end of the evening.
Yeah, sure.
Jim Catt was the Phillies starter for the day.
Jim Catt. Was he a cat of some sort?
Terrible question. He was a pitcher with no windup, and he had a tall task in front of him. Unfortunately,
wait a minute. So my question is stupid, but if I had asked, is he a pitcher with no windup, you would have said, incisive question, Trevor.
Yeah, but we'll never know because we don't have a time machine. Damn it.
We're back in the 60s again. Was 1960. The Cubs were...
A little ways to go before you ask me that question, and I can answer it differently. So we'll just go back to, yes, he was a pitcher with no windup. Jim Catt had a tall task in front of him, but fortunately he was very tall. The middle-aged bionic man, the paper called him.
You just mocked me, so no one would mock you for that.
Yes, I did. they called him the middle-aged bionic man. He was 37 years old. He had a 4.15 ERA against the Reds in 1976. Supposedly, he was going to mess with the Reds because his brief delivery would prevent them from stealing bases. By mess with the Reds, I mean, what? Inadvertently, he was going to, like, his style was going to mess with the Reds because, you know, it was so quick to the plate, they weren't going to be able to steal as many bases. But unfortunately for the Phillies, they did a ton of other stuff better than everyone other than just steal bases too. Yeah, so
that seems like a bizarre, that's like the kind of, that reminds me of like a Lenny Dykstra style strategy where it's like, not Lenny Dykstra, excuse me, Larry Boa style strategy where it's like, let's focus on one specific thing this team does and neutralize that. And then we'll win the game. And it's like, oh yeah, turns out baseball players, if they're really good, can do a lot of different things.
No. The numbers say that if he's facing to the right when the ball is hit, he's got a better turn radius, and he's going to be able to, you know, contort his body in a way that science has determined.
Reminds me of someone else who is no longer with the team.
Well, you know what's weird? Maybe it was some clubhouse policy at the time. Like I said, I know Dick Allen was probably not too keen on talking to reporters much by this point, but those Philly Inquirer writers, none of them actually talked to Phillies players stories.
I wonder why.
They just talked to Reds players about how they were going to beat the Phillies. For instance, the one guy sought out Joe Morgan, who was at his cockiest at this point, about how he'd beat Jim Catt in this game. And Morgan was like, I'm going to step out of the batter's box a lot, like all the time. And the umpire has to let me, and it's going to mess up his rhythm. Seriously, I mean, I don't expect the paper to slant towards the Phillies, but I have the lowest expectation for them to provide news on, like, about the
relevant
Phillies?
To the Philadelphia area. Welcome to the Philadelphia Inquirer, your location for Cincinnati Reds news.
that stuck out to me.
Strange. And they didn't report this to the Phillies. They were like, hey, you guys, they're gonna step out of the box a lot. Maybe mix up the old strategy.
Well, that was the other thing. They were just, players were literally just saying what they were going to do in the game.
They're just, like, constantly calling their shots. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah, when that happens, I'm going to hit a long home run off of him.
I'm going to swing at every 0-2 pitch I see tonight, and don't you tell anybody I said that.
I will hunt you down if my name is Pete Rose.
Well, that being said, as we know, it was very much on style for writers to just drop, throw and shit all over the team at this point. And they were good at it. I mean, it's super entertaining.
Like,
as much as I'm laughing at these for being anti-Phillies, I kind of love it. It's terrific writing. It's entertaining writing. Unfortunately, there's the racist slant to it that makes it less enjoyable when in regards to that one column about Dick Allen. Uh-huh. But like, it is good save. It is fun to see them, like, I don't know, be so squirrely about it.
It is pretty amazing to see someone actively not ask the Phillies questions. Like, that's what really gets me. It's like, right. Like, that seems like the one thing you can do as a Phillies beat writer. Like, even if they suck, even if it's an extremely frustrating team to cover, like, there's a million reasons why it wouldn't be a fun job. I get it. I really do. But, like, it's not so hard to ask them questions. And that seems like the easiest part of your job. It's just like content.
The thing is, it's today, and I'm probably is the case back then, like, today, reporters love to go out of their ways to say that they're not fans ridiculous, that they don't have biases. And I'm sure in most cases that's probably true, but, like, at least in the way they go about their jobs. But, like, the way these guys write, they sound so mad at this team for blowing it. And that, and by writing like that, they sound like they're huge fans.
That's what a fan would say. Yeah. Oh, you're mad that we blew it? That's what a fan would say.
Yeah. They sound like bloggers were, you know, like 10 years ago when it was all like, you know, oh, well, you got this slant. It's like, well, this is a fan site. And this, you know, when you're that upset, it's because you would have been equally as not upset if they had been winning, you know, like it's swings one way, swings back the other way.
I like imagining the version of what's his name? Colangelo from then. This is a normal way of talking to opposing teams. Find a new slant.
Find a new slant. The collar is normal.
The collar is normal. Find a new slant.
What an insane city.
So great.
Oh, what an insane, just the stupid worst city.
It's so
absolutely
good.
Terrible. So people were probably pissed, disgruntled, or hopeless, and the reporting reflected that at this time. So through the first six innings of Game 3 of the 1976 NLCS, only one run was scored. Mike Schmidt and Greg Luzinski led off the top of the fourth with back-to-back doubles, Bulls knocking in Schmidt and giving the Phillies their 1-0 lead. That was how the Phillies scored their next run, too, only this time it was Gary Maddux and Mike Schmidt who did the doubling. In the top of the seventh, but it had been a quiet affair to that point with six 1-2-3 innings between the two teams. The longest being the top of the sixth when the Phillies sent six men to the plate but failed to score. So, yeah, how is that possible? I feel like, in reading that, I'm like, I think that has to be the highest number of people you can send to the plate and not score. No, it's got to be seven. Like, if you, three guys get on with no outs and then the next three guys strike out. Because otherwise, if anything else other than an out happens, one of those runners is coming in. Yeah, so it's got to be seven, right?
No, it could. Bases loaded, ground ball hit. You could throw home, get the guy out at home, and then an error to first base, and then you'd have what, four, five.
That's a good point.
I know it's the same thing. You don't get any better, actually. It's
right. It's still six. An out.
Yeah.
It's still an out. Yeah.
I don't think there's any way to do it higher. I think six is the highest.
All right. So that's
wow. That's messed up.
They pulled that off. So it's
incredible.
Three.
Good work.
Three to nothing Phillies in the bottom of the seventh of this elimination game. You're probably feeling pretty good that they're going to pull off this like garbage time playoff win.
I can't wait. I think they can pull off the upset, man. I think they're going to sweep them.
If I'm a fan of a team and they're up 3-0 in the bottom of the seventh, my general thinking is, I think we got a pretty good shot at this one.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, I think that's
just
right.
From a timing standpoint, you know, putting aside all the specific issues with whoever's about to pitch or whatever. But, you know, it just seems likely. But, the Reds sprung to life, naturally. It was the big red machine. And, like, looking at the numbers and looking at the teams, the Phillies never should have. I mean, they didn't ever have a chance really against this team, and putting them next
team.
To each other, they're just, it's just, they were just fodder. They were just whoever the Reds had to step through on their way to the World Series.
It's
so
incredibly. Yeah. That's just like, that team's unreal.
I mean, listen to it's Ken Griffey and Joe Morgan led off this inning with a single and a walk.
Okay.
So then Tony Perez,
it's amazing
knocks
that he
run.
Played that long into the Mariners years too.
Yes,
they still called
good.
Him the kid. It's incredible.
Amazing. Still wore his hat backwards. Yeah, unbelievable. George Foster hits a sack fly.
Because you don't like show-offs, right?
Oh, I hate wear a hat like an American. Forward, upside down, and with five others stacked on top of it, like a normal person, like my father before me. So George Foster hits a sack fly, and two batters later, with two outs, Cesar Geronimo hits a two-run triple, giving the Reds a 4-3 lead. Now
that'll take the wind out of your sails.
You might think this was the dirty inning of the day, and the truth is, it's pretty dirty. The Phillies
not
had
great.
Been hold. Phillies had they'd been holding a monstrous Reds offense back until that moment, and their inability to tack on more runs had now cost them the lead. But this was an elimination game, remember, so I assure you, a much worse inning is coming. Because the Phillies weren't done. Jay Johnston doubled with one out in the eighth. Bob Boone walked, and the fourth ball was a wild pitch that let Johnston rush to third.
Oh, this is so great. They're going to win.
They were cooking, and Larry Boa turned the stove on with a game-tying RBI double. And on top of that, Dave Cash had a sack fly that gave him the lead. And you know what they say about late one-run leads in elimination playoff games?
They always hold up.
They last forever. That's correct. This is one of the few, many exceptions to that.
Unbelievable, really.
Very common saying, yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so we'll get to the rest of this game and what happened to our poor, sweet, sweet, poor, sweet, terrible, hated, desperately hated Phillies right after this break. Well, Trev, we were just talking about late one-run leads in elimination playoff games, like the one the Phillies had against the Reds on October 12, 1976, in the third game of the NLCS, their backs against the wall with a 2-0 deficit so far in the series. Fortunately for the Phillies, you know, they didn't have to worry too much about defending that one-run lead because it wasn't a one-run lead for very long.
This is
good news. I mean that in the best of ways. Johnston hit RBI triple in the ninth to give the Phillies an insurance run. Unfortunately for the Phillies, that didn't matter because you know what they say about late two-run leads in elimination
playoff
games?
They always fall through.
Nothing, because those people are all dead.
Whoa.
And so the bottom of the ninth arrived, the most pivotal inning of the Phillies' 1976 season, the frame that would determine whether it would end abruptly or continue indefinitely until the end of the World Series, the moment that decided who would live and who would die.
A lot of death.
With a dainty 6-4 lead, the Phillies entered the bottom of the ninth with reliever Ron Reed on the mound. With two pitches, he would prove the cutting, sarcastic, utterly disgusted Inquirer sports writing staff completely right. Before we go on, it has to be said here, Jim Catt did his job. 6 innings, 2 earned runs on only 2 hits and 2 walks. Catt gave the Phillies a chance to win, and they had it won. Twice. The offense came through not just once, but twice, mounting a lead, losing it, getting it back. If you're one of the two best teams in the NL, you should have a pitcher who can protect a 2-run lead for 3 outs. You know?
Yeah.
And you know what? Sparky Anderson, the Reds manager, assumed he'd be seeing the Phillies the next day for game 4. He thought the same thing. And you know what? He was not excited that his team would have to face Steve Carlton in that game. He did not want to have to loop back around to the start of the Phillies rotation.
Oh, man, it could have totally been different. This is a real sliding doors moment.
Yep, that was not a happy prospect and could very well have seen the series tied at 2-2. So, yeah, you know, maybe we're taking a couple leaps here, but hey, it's the reality of the situation. It's the fake reality of the situation.
Yeah, this is this.
It's the hypothetical reality of the situation.
It's not really the reality, but you know, it could be.
It's the opposite of reality, really.
It's sort of like the real reality.
If we delude ourselves, anything is real. Catt gave way to Ron Reed in the seventh when he allowed the first two batters to reach base, and that was the inning the Reds took the lead for the first time. Reed was still on the mound after the Phillies had taken the lead back, a move that was certainly a move. Typically, you know, in these days, you're going to see that pitcher come out of the game. Ron Reed was left in the game, so okay. Noted slugger George Foster led off the ninth inning, intending to get on base, obviously. He claimed in the paper later that he was looking to take some pitches to try and work a walk to just get it going. So he gets in the box, and he's standing there. And Reed goes through his delivery, because he actually had a delivery. And
unbelievable.
He just...
did that mess the Reds up?
Joe Morgan's head in the dugout just explodes.
No!
My plans! My precious plans! Reed goes through his delivery, and he just sends a strike down the middle of the plate to, again, noted slugger George Foster on pitch number 1. Now, he didn't hit this one, but Foster said later, I thought to myself, hey, he's not going to try and finesse me. He's going to challenge me. And at that point, he was just ringing a dinner bell. So he executed his plan, did Foster. Waited until the fourth pitch arrived. And that offering from Reed was high and tasty. Ooh. And Foster somehow kept from slobbering all over everyone and crushed it absolutely into the left field seats to make it 6-5. Reds still down a run. Carlton still possibly being faced the next day. But George Foster passed Johnny Bench on his way back to the dugout after clobbering that home run. Bench had only hit .234 during the regular season and only managed 16 home runs. Not exactly a power threat in 1976.
So he was having
a hard year, huh? Yeah. So, you know, no reason to fear Johnny Bench coming up with a one-run lead in the playoffs.
Certainly
in the elimination game.
Not.
The ninth inning, no outs, nothing to worry about here. But what wasn't threatening to these beaten-down, pathetic Phillies, as their local newspaper characterized them? I mean, Johnny Bench was Johnny Bench. And in true Johnny Bench fashion, he Johnny Benched Reed's 1-2 pitch to left center, and that 2-run lead became a 6-6 tie.
This is a really painful one, Justin.
Yeah, it sucks. At this point, tied and on the road.
I hate hearing this.
You know this game and this season are over.
No.
The momentum swing you have to pull off in that situation. It's not even a swing. It's a momentum pushing of a boulder up a mountain to come back from when you're the away team.
I know. They just would have won anyway. I get it. But boy, yikes.
And the problem was, I mean, not the problem, it's just what sucked was Ron Reed had been such a great pickup for the Phillies. He was 33. He was a 10-year veteran in Major League Baseball, and he had a 2.46 ERA through 128 innings that year for the Phillies.
That's great.
That is a great pitching pickup.
That's fantastic.
As Mitchell Nathanson described Ron Reed in The Fall of the 1977 Phillies, a book chronicling how the next Phillies team also blew it,
Reed was
the, quote, anti-Tug McGraw as far as temperament goes. This is a segment from that book by Mitchell Nathanson that I just read. I'm going to read a quick segment from that book entitled Into the Abyss.
Oh, man. This is a really depressing period of time for the Phillies.
I love it. Ron Reed was the anti-Tug McGraw. Where McGraw was exuberant, Reed was dour. Where McGraw was loose, Reed was wound as tight as an alarm clock before the first day of school. Unlike the alarm clock, however, no one ever knew when Reed was about to go off.
Is it normal to wind an alarm clock that much? Like, I don't want to interrupt. Doesn't that just hurt the alarm clock?
Well, in the 70s, I believe alarm clocks were wired with dynamite.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. You're right.
We were a dynamite powered nation at that point. It was extremely dangerous place to live. unlike the alarm clock, no one ever knew when Reed was about to go off, albeit in the clubhouse, never on the mound. In 1980, Reed would stew through much of the stretch drive, ultimately choosing to sit alone in Philadelphia International Airport, waiting for a plane to take him home rather than join his teammates for the victory parade down Broad Street.
Wow.
He was the only one not to show up at the celebration. On the mound, he was all business. He would never slap his glove on his thigh, pat his heart after a close call, or chat with invisible leprechauns between pitches. All quirks that made McGraw lovable the moment he arrived from the Mets 2 years earlier. So that's stuff, you know, this is talking to leprechauns. He's just talking to himself. This is just 70s colloquialism.
That's just someone being in the 70s. Great. Okay.
Right.
That's
helpful. being
now, excuse me.
I'm sorry. Your father is stricken with a fatal case of being from the 70s. Reed was supremely efficient and effective. In these final years, before the era of the closer as superstar would dawn, Reed oftentimes finished the game. His 15 saves led the team in 1977. In this era, however, who finished the game was less important than who came in when things got tough, regardless of the inning.
Wow, what a blinkered past.
And for the Phillies, Reed was, more often than not, the man in a bullpen replete with them when it came to such things. So that's Ron Reed's persona in a paragraph,
man.
And he's the only guy to show up for the parade. Dour man, what a very serious man, very serious.
Yeah.
So,
jeez,
can only imagine what his headspace was like when he gives up back to back home runs that tied a close elimination game in the ninth. So
I can't imagine he's happy.
Right.
Is that fair? Do you think that's fair? Do you think he's probably not feeling too good?
I think he went home and listened to some whale songs and just, you know, really got back in control of himself.
I was thinking about what Clayton Kershaw was feeling the other night, but now I'm really just thinking about what Ron Reed would have felt in Clayton Kershaw's shoes.
Yeah, well, that's I don't think we have any shots of Clayton like we had of Clayton Kershaw. It basically became a meme of a grown man, just emotionally devastated, staring at the ground. I mean, I don't know if you
Nothing's
saw footage.
Funnier than that.
I don't know if you saw footage of second string Steelers quarterback Mason Rudolph losing consciousness from a hit.
Yes,
last weekend.
I did.
If you've ever seen the light go out behind a man's eyes, that is captured in, you know, clear as day by NFL cameras. The emotional equivalent of that happened to Clayton Kershaw, I would say.
God, that was so rough.
Yeah. And so with Ron Reed, probably wasn't much better. I mean, so what? The Phillies could get the lead back, right? Gene Garber came on, gave up a single, and left the game, bringing on 22-year-old Phillies reliever Tom Underwood. Okay. Underwood had been used mostly as a starter and hadn't pitched in 2 weeks. Tug McGraw had
heard this story before.
Tug McGraw had a spasm in his back and couldn't pitch. And apparently Tom Underwood was the next best option.
Sure. I guess.
Well, Underwood couldn't get the ball over the plate with a runner on first. Cesar Geronimo was trying to bunt, but took the walk Underwood was so happy to give him. The Reds sacrificed the runners into scoring position, and Phillies manager Danny Ozark obviously had Underwood intentionally walk Pete Rose.
Sure, because he read that article about...
Right, exactly. That brought Ken Griffey to the plate with the bases loaded.
Wonder what happens here.
There's just no end to these Reds, Trev. Every player was a threat. You couldn't get around them, so you can understand why they felt so inevitable or why Frank Dolson wrote the Inquirer the next day. It was just an incredibly tough spot against a team that was going to win this game one way or another. Once Bench's drive cleared the wall to tie the score, it was only a matter of time. You could feel it. Everybody in the ballpark could feel it.
Man.
Well, Griffey could have done just about anything in that spot and won the Reds the game, outside of making an out, but he didn't do just about anything. He swatted a bad pitch towards first base, where Bobby Tolan of the Phillies tried a little too hard to make the play with Dave Concepcion running from third. He was definitely going to score, Concepcion was, it seems, even if Tolan fielded the ball well. Mm-hmm. And he did. He scored. The Reds won 7-6. The NLCS was over.
Yeah.
The Phillies were lost, and they watched another team celebrate for the first of three consecutive years. As hilarious, bittersweet luck would have it, Danny Ozark, the Phillies manager, was actually named Manager of the Year on the same day.
Oh, no.
Listen to this. He tells the paper, "A nice honor, but I would have traded it for three wins."
Oh, that's dark.
I honestly felt more emotionally touched by this episode of this podcast than I did by any probably real Phillies game. Well, this was a real Phillies game, but any Phillies game I've witnessed myself
this
year.
This one was extremely hard to listen to.
Well, you know, you think about guys' reactions after games like this. The season is over. You put in a long season, and even put aside the wild card game stuff, your season comes down to a best of five series, and you're just like, wow, that happened so fast, and it's all over.
Yeah.
And you always wonder, you know, again, these days you get a lot of the same kind of sounding quotes, but the reaction's obviously going to be a little morose, and guys may not want to pour their hearts out to a reporter, especially right after the fact. They might just be like, they probably just want to get out of here. It's not really something to dwell on right now and have a camera in my face.
No, I don't want
but,
it. Go away.
The Danny Ozark quote was bad, but Dave Cash talked to reporters after the game, and as he put it, he said something that was like how I've always really envisioned it, and I think we can always just assume is the way players feel after a game like this, which is, it won't hit us until tomorrow. It won't hit us until we get up in the morning and there's nothing to do.
Oh, jeez.
Pack your bags, head out.
Packed
another team's going to the World Series.
Last night. Pre-flight.
Brutal.
Oh, man. So this is the one you chose.
Yes. Hey, it's an NLCS, Trev, the NLCS. We had to do it tonight. The NLCS is going to be over, apparently, you know, not after this game. Can't see the Cardinals coming back. They're down 8-1 now as we're recording this. The Nationals felt confident enough to put Fernando Rodney in the game, so there's a garbage time pitcher in an NLCS game. Thrilling.
Did Fernando Rodney not have a good year?
No, I mean, he's definitely not their best choice. The Nationals bullpen,
it's unbelievable, right?
Did not have a good year.
I mean, unbelievably bad.
Yeah, yeah. They got Daniel Hudson and Sean Doolittle. So anybody else is rolling the dice. But, I mean, at this point, who cares? They're up by 7 runs. The Cardinals look like nothing. And, yeah, and that's just the way it is sometimes.
How strange.
That's what the Phillies learned in 1976. And hopefully the next time we see the Phillies in the NLCS, the Phillies will be in it. And they won't suffer anything close to what the 1976 Phillies had to go through. God. So,
honestly,
I
had to see that. That would be, I just would be way too much. I couldn't see that.
Well, if you enjoyed this story, you'll enjoy any of the stories we tell here on the Dirty Inning.
I would argue
where
you will enjoy some of them more.
Probably a lot of them you will enjoy more. Sometimes we even talk about Phillies winning games. But
every so often.
We tend to dwell, again, on some of the most forgotten games. The playoffs are hard because everybody typically remembers the playoff games. But I felt like, you know what? 76 doesn't get, you know, talked about
no,
a whole
to
lot.
Me, to me, this is like, this is, I've never heard of this game. And it is crushing.
Yeah. So I feel like we would share that with us. We get one more heartbreak in before the end of the baseball season and we start the long, long winter towards the next Phillies season.
Justin, can I ask you a question before we go?
Sure.
Are you going to be excited for baseball by February?
I think so. I always am, typically.
Okay. Second question. What managerial choice would make you not excited at all for baseball?
That's a great question. To make me not excited. See, it's a great question because all the names right now being considered are these just like, well, guys who were managers and became famous for being managers, but who aren't currently managers. And it's just kind of the default answer for who teams are going to look at of any of the eight teams that are filling out the manager role
sure.
this offseason. And of those three guys, none of them would really make me utterly discouraged. It would have to be somebody I haven't thought of, you know, and I just don't think the Phillies are going to go into that side of the pool this time as far as like, oh, well, why don't we just go with like a strong willed first time manager with no experience who people don't know of. Like, I think they're going to stay away from that.
Matt Klentak might push for it. He still believes in Gabe.
Sure.
Who,
you know what?
Fired.
Let's see something. Let's see something utterly ridiculous go down. I mean that would be fun.
I would lose. I would stop watching if Curt Schilling got the job.
I mean, you wouldn't be the only one. Like that will never happen. Like I am deeply cynical about the backroom dealings of every Major League Baseball team. But like even the Phillies would have to acknowledge that welcoming Curt Schilling back with open arms for a reunion. Is, you know, dog shit, but like even the Phillies would have to recognize that hiring him as your manager is obviously out of the question.
It would be really amazing.
Standpoint.
I mean, I can't even imagine.
It would make it really easy not to watch.
It would be unwatchable. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Justin.
Well, in the interim, leading up to the next Phillies season, please subscribe, rate, and download all of their favorite Phillies podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and The Dirty Inning with me and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We enjoy bringing these stories to you every time we do, so thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.